Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film, and thank you so much, as always, for subscribing. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
This week, we're talking WandaVision, The Rental, 76 Days, and Bill and Ted Face the Music, plus our all-time greatest buddy movies. But first of all, let's get stuck into what's taking over television, in more ways than one, with this.
It's twilight time.
Wanda and Vision, aren't we a five pair?
This is our home now. I want us to fit in.
Oh, this is gonna be a gas!
Where did you two move from? How long have you been married, and why don't you have children yet?
Our story.
I think what my wife means to say is that we moved from...
Moved from where? Married when? Damn it, why?
Oh, Arthur, stop it. Stop it.
Okay, so this is WandaVision, Marvel's foray into TV. Matthew, it's about Wanda and Vision, but where do we find them?
Apparently, they've relocated to the suburbs. Well, in episode one, they seem to be in the 1950s, and in episode two, it seems to be the 1960s. So it's not entirely clear where or when they are at present, but this is apparently all set after Avengers Endgame. However, as we saw in Infinity War, Vision died. So Vision has been mysteriously resurrected into this sitcom land, this kind of Truman Show meets Pleasantville type environment. They're sort of a typical but not typical couple. The only difference really between them and everybody else is that Wanda is a superpowered mutant and Vision is a robot. Otherwise, they're just your regular married couple kind of negotiating all the obstacles and pitfalls of suburban life. But there's some other mysterious stuff going on as well. They seem to be being monitored by someone who keeps reaching out to Wanda. There's little dashes of colour that keep interrupting the action and intruders here and there. And they seem to be having little flashes of self-awareness of what's going on. So it's all a great victory kind of wrapped up in this sitcom pastiche homage.
It's very faithfully done, isn't it? I mean, they filmed the first two episodes in front of a studio audience. They did the sort of levitating plates as physical effects. Yeah. It's very painstakingly done. But does it work? Are you intrigued?
I'm really, really enjoying it. I'm really into it. It's so different from anything Marvel's done before. I mean, there's been no kind of conventional superhero action so far, you know, of the three episodes I've seen. You know, it's a real departure. It's so postmodern it hurts, quite frankly. But at the same time, it kind of works as a regular sitcom. I mean, the first one, it had a real sort of classic sitcom setup with the bosses coming to dinner. Oh, no, we've forgotten. Got to impress the boss, which we've seen hundreds of times before in other sitcoms with all these kind of sort of hokey but funny comic coincidences going on. But there is this whole other meta level, and there's lots of Easter eggs for Marvel fans, but it can be enjoyed on its own merits. I just think it's absolutely terrific. It's such a breath of fresh air for the superhero genre, and I'm so excited to see where it's going to go next in the six remaining episodes.
Do you like it, Matt?
I really enjoyed it as well. I've only seen the first two episodes, which are currently available now on Disney Plus. You guys have obviously seen the third as well, which is out tomorrow. And I can't wait to see that one because I love the first two. Like Matthew, I love that it was so different to what we've seen from other superhero films. We've had such a big break from the MCU now due to COVID and everything. So this is obviously our first of MCU action for a long while. I just found it really funny. And I particularly think that those two, Paul Bettany and Elizabeth Olsen, are probably among two of the most kind of versatile actors in the MCU. So to get them to kind of showcase these different styles and get to do something a bit different, I'm just really enjoying that aspect. And I do feel very intrigued because, yeah, like I said, I've only seen the first two, but we see that weird kind of hand in front of the TV at the end of the first episode. So something weird's going on, you know, and obviously I've seen the little red and yellow drone drop in the second episode. I mean, I don't know what to expect in the third, you know. And how about you, Jane? Have you been digging it?
I don't. I mean, I love what they're doing. I love the care that they're taking with it and the fact that it is so spot on retro. But I think it's taking a bit too long. I understand the argument that TV gives you this time and space to really explore, but I feel like I could have done with the first three episodes hurrying a bit. I want to get to where we're going with this. It's been a bit leisurely for my liking. I'm hoping now we've watched, obviously, Matthew and I have watched three, and stuff has begun to get a bit weird and it's starting to break that template. But I feel like by episode three, I wanted that to be starting at the end of one and then continuing to two and then amping up. I want my Avengers fix to be, you know, cracking on with it more. Obviously, we only watched three, so maybe it's going to be breakneck. And obviously, something does happen in episode three that is occurring at breakneck speed. So perhaps now it's really going to amp up and we're really going to get somewhere. And that intrigue has really started to be loaded on. Who are the neighbours? What are they doing? What's their story? Is there a Stepford Wife thing going on here? What's beyond Westview? No one leaves Westview. Why in the first episode does the boss's wife just keep saying, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it? It's like, what? So I think it's probably going to be one of those things that as a whole, when you see the whole, you'll be like, this worked beautifully. But right now, I'm sort of a little bit unsure.
Yeah,
this is a weird thing to say now, but I almost found myself after those first two episodes thinking, I can imagine myself re-watching this just to kind of enjoy it, you know, like you say, in the care and attention. And like you say, especially once it's all there and you can watch all
in close succession,
I think that will be fun. And, you know, going through the different decades. And the thing is, I mean, they have kind of promised like huge action and visual effects and things, you know, like, so something's got to be coming down the line. But I'm a bit...
Who's the beekeeper?
I'm often like you, Jane, in that like I don't like it when things move too slowly. Like I found the Mandalorian second season, the first few episodes of that moved a bit too slowly. I don't like it when you feel like they're kind of treading water. But again, I think because it was so different, I was just happy to kind of indulge in it.
Yeah.
And the thing I did like about it is their relationship. I mean, I think it's they're often sidelined in the Avengers movies, or sort of, you know, moping around Edinburgh or whatever they're doing. And in this, you actually do believe they're a couple and that they love each other and they would love to be a family together. I don't think I've ever felt that before in any of the films. So on that level, it's really working. It's bedding in with me on that level.
Yeah, there are all these sort of connections to the Marvel Universe as well. Monica Rambeau, who was last seen as a child in Captain Marvel, which she now seems to have changed her name to Geraldine, but there's obviously a connection there to the wider Marvel Universe that's going to come out. And she's quite a significant character in the comics as well. So perhaps they're building up to that. Scarlet Witch is apparently going to be in the Doctor Strange sequel that's coming out in the Multiverse of Madness. So I'm wondering if it's going to tie into that at some point and perhaps lead on to this bigger action, bigger scale.
This points to being consciousness, doesn't it? And not reality. You know, Doctor Strange does enjoy zapping around the place. Maybe he'll tumble into this show. Who knows?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of special guest, hasn't there? Somewhere.
Yeah.
I love the little fake adverts you get as well in there.
Yeah.
That even in those adverts, like on the first one for the toaster, the light glows red, and then in the next thing, it's the little red helicopter and stuff, and these things are building, and like, what do they mean? It will become apparent. And also, you know, like we're all in lockdown again, so it's good to have some Avengers-y stuff to watch, right?
Yeah.
To me as well, it's good to have it weekly as well, so that you sort of spread it out and it's something to keep you going through this kind of dull first portion of the year where, we're all just stuck indoors mostly.
But I think that's why I'm so greedy. I want to be able to watch the whole shebang now, and that's why it feels slow to me, maybe.
Yeah.
But we can highly recommend it, can't we?
Yes.
So if you haven't had a go on WandaVision yet, it is currently available on Disney Plus, and it's rolling out weekly, so you can just have a little taste of it every week and enjoy it. Okay, so shall we move on? Do you fancy a trip away, boys? You may not after this.
Charlie! Tell me that's not a camera.
Through the night. We leave first thing in the morning. What's going on?
I don't know.
Okay, so this is The Rental. Matt, what's being rented and by who?
Okay, so this is the directorial debut of Dave Franco, who we kind of generally best know as a comedy actor and brother of James Franco. He's also co-written the screenplay here with mumblecore mainstay Joe Swanberg. So it's all centered around this Airbnb trip, basically, which is taken by this group of four close-knit friends who are Charlie, played by Dan Stevens. Then there's Charlie's wife, Michelle, played by Alison Brie, who's, of course, Dave Franco's real-life wife. Then you've got Mina, played by Sheila Vand, and she is Dan Stevens' business partner. And then there's her boyfriend, Josh, played by Jeremy Allen White, and he's also Dan Stevens' character, Charlie's brother. So there's this very tight connection between them all. And again, it's harder to explain than it is to watch, I find, with that. But they're all very connected through work and friendship and relationships. And then basically they go for a weekend away in this sort of lovely Airbnb coastal property. They bring some drugs, you know, and they're just planning to chill. But it gets off to a weird start when the guy who lets them in, who's, you know, related to the host, just there's something a bit sinister about him. And they're suspicious that it seemed like he rejected Mina's request to rent the place, perhaps because she didn't have like an all-American name. So there's that bit of tension right from the beginning. It basically gets a bit spooky from there.
So, I mean, this feels like a sort of throwback in a good way, right? I felt like I was watching a sort of Pacific Heights or a film like that where the mundane becomes terrifying. And we've all rented an Airbnb and probably had an interaction with a weird host or wondered, are they spying on us? Or why have they done this and left this in the cupboard? And why is this weird picture in the drawer? So I love that it sort of taps into that very modern experience, but it's purely sort of old school slasher thrills, isn't it?
Yeah, I must admit, full disclosure, I spoke to Dave Franco for a piece in the current issue of Total Film on sale now, if you want to read it.
Nice.
That was basically, obviously, he said it was inspired by his own nerves about staying in Airbnb style kind of, you know, rentals. And what I think it does really well as well, which he kind of spoke about this, but I really did think he captured this well, is that you're kind of as interested as this sort of weird tension that's going on with the group dynamic. And you've got the kind of slacker brother, you've got the kind of sort of sexual chemistry between the co-workers, you've got the sort of, you know, husband and wife kind of tension there as well. And all that is kind of really interesting and knotty and kind of fun, as well as this kind of, you know, creepy slasher sort of activity going on in the background. So it doesn't feel as sort of throwaway as some slashers, because you have all that kind of, you know, character intrigue in there. And it just sort of, you know, then ratchets up as this sort of creepiness starts. But I really like that there was that kind of character stuff to dig into as well.
Yeah, because you know usually on this they'd be like, who cares, just girl one boyfriend, and then the stabbing begins and we don't really care. But actually I felt invested in them, and I recognize these people, I know these people. You know, I really did feel I mean, you know, someone who will always bring a dog to a no dogs allowed property. Yeah, we've all got a friend like that. Or the girl that brings the drugs and then says, no, I'm going to go to bed early and not do the drugs, and then complain when everyone else is hungover the next day. You know, those little sort of real touches felt really good, so that when the bloodletting started, I was terrified for them. Did you like it, Matthew?
I did, yeah. I mean, it's real watch through your fingers stuff as it goes on. There's one sequence, I think, kind of about two-thirds in, where it's cross-cutting between one treacherous situation and another, and the tension just ramps right up. I mean, it's kind of almost unbearable where you get these two situations coming to a head. So it's very clever the way he weaves together the relationship drama with all the real sort of hardcore horror stuff and how they play off each other. It's kind of a very enjoyably unpleasant experience, I found, overall.
Brisk as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
this doesn't outstay its welcome.
Doesn't mess about, no.
I can imagine if you watched it in a Airbnb, you might start to have a little look in your shower head and other places.
Well, scare B&B.
Scare B&B.
That was my headline for my...
Very good.
Oh, well, there you go.
I really loved Alison Brie. I just keep loving her in things. I just saw her in Promising Young Woman. And I just think she's so good at that sort of brittle woman who is trying to portray sort of free and easy, but is actually quite controlling. And passive aggressiveness that she does in this is really good. I think she's excellent. But also Dan Stevens. What a palate cleanser from Blythe Spirit last week. He's great in this.
Yeah, it's a lot more nuanced and subtle on that, isn't it, compared to shrieking and running around and things popping out of the woodwork. Yeah, it's nice to see him back on track straight away.
So that is The Rental, which I think we'd say it's a weekend popcorn movie that everyone should have a go on, right?
Yeah.
It's available on all platforms from tomorrow. Perfect for the weekend. Okay, so from one kind of terror to another. It's this.
That was 76 Days. Jane, tell us what this one's about because we haven't seen it.
So this is a documentary about the COVID crisis, but it's unusual in as much as it starts on day one in Wuhan province. And this premiered at TIFF, which is where I saw it. It's kind of incredible to watch with the benefit of hindsight to know how this is going to mushroom and how what you're seeing just beginning in China is going to become this year, more than a year, global catastrophe. So it just is a very ordinary documentary, and as much as it literally just follows the emergency workers that are trying desperately to see the people that are tumbling through their door, literally banging on the door, trying to get in almost in a zombie apocalypse fashion, because the cases are just rising and their realization that this is something that is spreading super fast. And also the fact that they're realizing a hideous emotional toll that this catastrophe is going to take on families, because we see, you know, a woman who cannot say goodbye to her father and he's dying in one room. She's completely PPE'd up and she's being held back from entering the room. And she is a grown woman wailing for her daddy. And this is affecting obviously all the staff that are looking after him. It's a tricky one to recommend because really, you know, we're all in it. Who wants to actually watch this? But the thing that's interesting is seeing it at its inception of where it starts and how it grows, and seeing the panic and the hugeness that it becomes very quickly in Wuhan, which we all then obviously see. But also, you know, it is again another one of these things that's testament to the people that are working on the front line, and, you know, the people who are tired, overworked, overstretched, doing their best, putting themselves in danger to look after people who are desperately ill and desperately infectious. And I think if you feel any ounce of that for the NHS in the UK or anywhere around the world, on that level, it's a great sort of testament to their work and their ethics. Would you fancy watching it, though? I don't know, because obviously it's not fun.
Yeah.
How does it compare to Collective? I mean, obviously that wasn't about pandemic, but there's a lot of parallels there. Is it kind of in a similar vein to that?
I mean, I think Collective is far more political for obvious reasons, and far more, you know, about the ethics of what's going on in that particular film. Okay. And it's grim on a whole different level, isn't it?
I
think this is just more a bit doom scrolly, isn't it? But it is informing yourself of something that we are all impacted by. So it is quite interesting from that point of view. And also, you know, I enjoyed watching Wuhan. You know, it's this place that's been on the news for however many months we've been listening to this, and they are back to normal now. And so to see it sort of begin to fracture and the streets to clear and this catastrophe to happen there, it was interesting to see the actual place that you've heard about on the news so much.
Yeah. Do you think this is the tip of the iceberg for COVID documentaries? Do you think we're going to get a great wave of them coming this year, next year?
Surely we're going to get COVID everything, aren't we? We're going to get COVID drama, COVID heist. We've got a COVID heist coming with the lockdown. We're probably going to get a lot more of it. But if you fancy seeing this and educating yourself on what it really was like at the beginning, it's kind of interesting. But I can't recommend it as fun viewing. Okay, so that is 76 Days, first 76 days of the COVID crisis. And that's available on all platforms from tomorrow. We probably need cheering up, don't we? This is out on all formats.
Bill, Ted, enough of the delusions. You didn't time travel. And you didn't go to heaven and hell. Here's a real idea for you. Be role models to your daughters. Get real jobs.
We've spent our whole life trying to unite the world. And I'm tired, dude.
Ted, we have a destiny to fulfill.
Whoa. Greetings, my excellent friend.
So this is Bill and Ted Face the Music, which too long didn't read. Bill and Ted are back 20-odd years later, and they are going to time travel again. We loved it when it came out as a bit of sort of silly throwback fluff and entertainment and watching Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves back together again. Would you want to keep it? Is it something you're going to add to your video collection? I say video collection. I mean, of course, your Blu-ray.
It's in the spirit of Bill and Ted, isn't it?
Yeah, VHS. Yeah. I still have a VHS collection, thank you very much, and a VHS player, as well as everything else. But I like sometimes to put a creaky old VHS in and watch it with all of the crackles.
Yeah, snowstorm static.
Are you adding this to your collection?
Did this even come out in the cinema in the UK? I can't even remember. Yeah, did it just go straight to digital? Yeah. Because I'm so used to the sort of typical, like, you know, films come out in a cinema, then after an appropriate window, they come out, you know, for rental and home ent. Now I'm just completely thrown. I was like, oh, did it come out before then? But I mean, I certainly feel like it's sort of, it's come round again at an appropriate time where I need kind of cheering up and need a bit of a nostalgic glow again. So it'd definitely be worth giving it a whirl for that. But it might be more of a kind of digital rental for me to kind of pass the time now rather than something I'll want in, you know, physical for posterity. I don't think I'll be revisiting it that often in the future.
It's also one of those things, isn't it? Like Bill and Ted occupies a really nostalgic place in my heart and I love it. But actually when we revisited one and two, when we were thinking about looking at this film, we realized they were not that great when you watch them now. And so I sort of wish I hadn't, because I kind of fell out of love with them a little bit, having seen them recently. And so I'm not sure that this hit me quite the way it should have done. I think maybe if I hadn't gone back and watched them and I still had that idea of what those films were like in my head, I would have enjoyed this a bit more. But if you're a huge fan of these guys and, you know, their dopey adventures, why would you not complete the trilogy and have this on the shelf as well?
There's so many callbacks and throwbacks and recurring cast members from the originals. I mean, it's kind of been quite lovingly made. I mean, all the parents come back, Death comes back. There's just ample references to previous jokes. So if you are a big fan, there's a huge amount of fan service in there for you. And I think it works quite well for new viewers as well, because the daughters give a kind of a fresh energy. And I think in a way they kind of play Bill and Ted better than Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter do really now. I mean, even though they kind of go for it, they bring some gusto, it doesn't feel quite the same now that they're into middle age. So I kind of enjoyed it. It felt like a one watch only for me, really. I think I'd watch it if I strayed across it on TV, but I think that there was enough goodwill from the others to kind of carry it through.
Okay, so if you want to get some Bill and Ted number 3 in your life, it is now available on all formats, whatever that may be. Sadly not VHS. Missed a trick there, because I could have added that. Okay, Bill and Ted are one of cinema's most iconic duos and were high in Total Film's recent list of greatest buddy movies. But are they the best? Court now is in session to find the best of celluloid besties. Matt, state your movie and your case.
So for me, it's got to be this.
Morning, Sally.
Morning, Sally.
How you doing, big guy?
Hey.
Go get him, Mr. Sullivan. Quiet. You're making him lose his focus. Oh, no. Sorry.
So, of course, that's Mike Wazowski and James P. Sullivan from Monsters, Inc. I chose these two, maybe even controversially above Woody and Buzz. I think the friendship is much truer and more believable in Monsters, Inc. Like Woody and Buzz are kind of forced together through circumstances, but Mike and Sully are just true friends, you know, longtime workmates. They work well together, literally, at Monsters Incorporated as kind of, you know, Mike's obviously the scare manager. Sully's the top scarer, collecting all those screams, later laughs, of course. And I just think they're two of Pixar's funniest characters. I just love it. I love Mike's kind of optimism. I like that we kind of, you know, we see different sides of their relationships where Mike's got Cecilia and then obviously Sully, you know, reveals his softer side with Boo when she comes into the picture. They're just so great together. I just, yeah, can just always watch that film.
And it's also, it's great voice acting, isn't it? Like you, I mean, those guys are friends in real life and you really believe that from their sort of vocals.
Yeah, Billy Crystal is just one of the funniest ever, like Pixar voice actor performances, I think. I have a soft spot for Monsters University. I know it's not as loved, rightly so, as Monsters, Inc. And it doesn't have any of that kind of profundity. And, you know, it lacks a bit of, you know, what makes Monsters, Inc. so special. But I still just think it's just immensely great fun to see those two at college and like having those kind of classic college movie larks. So those are my favorite two movie buddies.
I also like that they're so like different in stature and everything. One's furry and one's sort of shiny and a giant eyeball on legs. And just like, why would these guys be friends? But they are. That is how friendship works, isn't it? Just like chalk and cheese, yin and yang. And you get together and you have this great relationship. So yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. I like it. But Matthew,
is it the best?
What have you got to offer? What are you bringing to the court?
Well, I'm just going to say two words. Punch it.
I'm hurrying.
Chewie. We're home.
So, Matthew, this is the case for Han and Chewie in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Come on then, why are they awesome? Why are they better than Mike and Sully?
Well, where do I start? I mean, this partnership has gone on for decades and decades. We first met them in 1977 in A New Hope. I mean, the film's great up until this point anyway, but when they arrive, they just send it into overdrive, the kind of the laid-back, cocky smuggler, and he's their first mate and best mate, Chewbacca, the walking carpet. Can't understand a word he says, but Han understands every syllable. It just goes deeper than language, the way they communicate with each other. They're absolute BFFs, and that relationship continues through the sequels into the later sequels. I mean, I think it's really telling that in the first big trailer for The Force Awakens, the big reveal they saved for the end, it wasn't some special effect, wasn't some explosion. It was Han and Chewie together again. And I think if you'd had one of them on their own, it would have been amazing. But to have both of them together, it just absolutely took the roof off because they belong together. It's the greatest bromance in the universe.
Mm. I also love that Chewie just doesn't stand for any of Han's bullshit, does he? It's like Leia to a lesser extent, but he's really the guy that will say, no, cocky space pirate. You know, you're talking nonsense and you need to man up and sort yourself out and do the right thing and things like that. I love that he does that, but yeah.
But the love is always there. You can always feel the love, even though they might fall out or grumble at each other. But, you know, that bond is just absolutely unbreakable.
One thing I almost embarrassingly sort of shed a tear over was after The Force Awakens came out, I saw this little online comic that was about Chewie and Ben Solo, and it kind of, you saw them together as Ben was growing up, and then they kind of used that to explain that's why he didn't kind of kill him when he had the chance.
Yeah, he couldn't, yeah.
On the bridge.
Heartbreak.
And that was all.
When Chewie has his little weep on the Millennium Falcon after Han's died, he goes off by his own and sits there on his own, and it's just that's one of the most heartbreaking moments in all of Star Wars.
It's going to get very, he seems quite adrift having a weep. That.
Yeah, but you'd love to hug him though, wouldn't you? I mean, he's so huggable.
Yeah. I don't know. I think
that's
smell.
That's what all the cast say, basically, don't they? Like all the cast that worked on the new Star Wars films, they just want a hug from Chewie, basically.
Yeah, like Simon Pegg went for it, didn't he? He was straight in there. Harrison Ford and Peter Mayhew seem to have quite a lovely relationship off screen as well. Harrison Ford seemed he did this quite moving tribute to him after Peter Mayhew died last year. So it's nice to know they were buddies in real life. That's the icing on the cake for me.
It's a hard one to beat. They really are, just for length of service to each other and, you know, all of the adventures they've been through, and they're still besties. It's a good one, but I'm going to throw something else into the mix.
I'll have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma!
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it?
Okay, so this is obviously Thelma and Louise.
Of course.
You know, these girls are super great friends. Not only, you know, does Louise sort of chastise Thelma for being, you know, married to a man who she has to ask permission to do anything, and she's like, is he your husband or your father? She knows that the thing that Thelma needs is a holiday, so she takes her for a holiday. That's great friendship. Then obviously, as we know, things don't go brilliantly on that holiday, and things go very badly wrong to a criminal level. And yet these two girls stick together and ultimately stick together for the ultimate holiday, shall we say, the ultimate journey elsewhere to a different plane, even when facing all of these helicopters and police units and the end of the road, they decide that they want to continue together, even if that means off the edge of a cliff. And I just think that is the ultimate friendship. They out friendship Romeo and Michelle or the girls from Booksmart. These are girls that literally friendship never dies. That's my case, my lud.
They are iconic. I mean, you can just tell from the amount of times they've been homaged and parodied. Like French and Saunders did a particularly good send-up of that film. I mean, that's kind of testament to what icons they are. I mean, it's 3 decades now, isn't it? It's 30 years since that film came out. It still feels fresh and original.
And you think about the fact that they were not sort of the original choices for it. I think it was Jodie Foster and Michelle Pfeiffer, which I can see, but I just think, yeah. I love Bull Durham, but I don't think that Susan Sarandon has ever been better in Thelma and Louise. She's so cool and does exactly what she wants and takes no shit from anybody. I love her, and so I think she's really great. And talking of casting, would it have been the same if George Clooney had played JD? He auditioned 5 times, but Brad Pitt
Brad got it.
I imagine anyone other than Brad Pitt there, though, can you?
So Holly Hunter, Frances McDormand, Jodie Foster, Michelle Pfeiffer, Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn were all considered for Thelma and Louise. And I don't think any of them could have done as much justice to the roles as Gina and Susan. They were absolutely amazing.
Went the right way, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. So that's mine. So what do we think? I mean, obviously, there's so many others to pick from.
Yeah, we've also got a few suggestions from people on Twitter. Jodie, who's at Tia Matt Noir, she says, Jay and Silent Bob, they complement each other so well.
Yeah, they are good
influenced
friends.
By Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
Simon Brennan at Simon909, he says, growing up, it was Riggs and Myrtle in the Lethal Weapons series, especially the first two. They just seem to be having so much fun making the films, which, again, it's that thing. It's that kind of, if you sense their buddies behind the scenes, that's always an added buddy bonus.
Yeah, can't disagree with that one.
Jeroen, who's at Jertim, says he picks Bad Boys and says two different types of comedians who let each other do their thing and riff off each other in addition to being badass. Which, again, that's another, I suppose that's one element that Mike and Sully lack, to be fair.
Yeah, they're not particularly badass. I can't imagine Mike and Sully like driving a Porsche.
No.
Well, they do get Mike's new car. I like the short Mike's new car. Check it out if you haven't seen it. And yeah, and finally, Derek Norwell at Dirk Norwell. He says Corbin Dallas and Lilu from The Fifth Element. And he says difficult to beat these two because of their comic performance, saving the world from a demented Zorg and falling in love despite the odds. 10 out of 10 is what he says. So again, a good shout.
There are so many to choose from. I mean, I mentioned Romeo and Michelle. They are crackers.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
What about Butch and Sundance? What about Bodie and Johnny or Cap and Bucky or Rocket and Groot? Mm. It's clear that this is something we love to watch, isn't it? We love to see mates on screen having, you know, being there for each other through thick and thin. If you have any other suggestions, do let us know on Twitter at Total Film. But for now, for our court, who are we going for? I think, much as I love mine, I think I probably have to agree with Han and Chewie as all-time orcas. What about you, Matt?
I'll let Matthew have that one,
Okay, very nice. So for this, that was so good. So for this particular session, we will go for Han and Chewie as our number one. But before we go as well, shall we answer a reader's question? What film set in what city does a good job of transporting you on a virtual holiday? Matthew?
I'm going to go with my recent favourite of 2020, On the Rocks, which had quite a picturesque view of New York. I mean, it doesn't show you the grimmer bits, but yeah, I mean, it brought back happy memories of being in New York, and it's an absolutely lovely film as well. Beautiful views of the city. I really enjoyed that. That was a real palate cleanser late last year.
Matt?
And if I may go for a preview of a film that I hope will be like a good holiday, and also another film you could read about in the current issue of Total Film, if you so wish, is the upcoming Pixar film Luca, which is set on the Italian Riviera. And just based on sort of what I know about the film and, you know, images and things like that I've seen, it just really looks like it's going to be an escape. And, you know, obviously it's had those kind of Call Me By Your Name comparisons already. It just really does look like it will just kind of take you away. And then especially as, you know, who knows, by the summer, we might not be that easy to travel, you know. So I think this looks like it will be a good way to get away without having to go sort of any further than your cinema. That's mine. What about you, Jane?
I mean, pretty much any Bond film is like going on a trip, isn't it? Because of the fact that they really lean into their locales and you really get a sense of somewhere because... You know, even if it's Moonraker, you understand how cool Rio de Janeiro might be and you want to go. When I went to Rio de Janeiro, I wanted to go on the cable car up to Sugarloaf Mountain, and I really would have liked to have had a fight on top of it with Jaws, but sadly not available and not safe. Didn't do that. And also I'd have to say The Talented Mr. Ripley is one of my all-time favourites for really... I would just want to put, you know, my swimming cosy on and sit out in the sun with... lovely Gwyneth Paltrow and Jude Law as they sit on Positano Beach. Just looks beautiful. And also Rome is really nicely captured there. And if we're in Italy, you mentioned Call Me By Your Name, I do think that does a really good job of Italy, obviously. And so good that I actually did visit Crema, where it's set, and enjoyed my own Call Me By Your Name weekend. So, yeah, that always works for me. But we won't be going anywhere, will we, for any time soon?
Well, films are going to be the only sort of travelling we're going to do,
the only
aren't
they, for, at the moment.
For a good while.
Oh, and also, we probably should mention Lost in Translation as well, because who doesn't want to go to Tokyo having seen that film? Yeah. It just makes it look beautiful. And I go to Kyoto and look at the temples and then to do karaoke looks fantastic. So I love that about film as well, don't you? That it really makes you feel like you're someplace different.
Yeah.
Because when you were talking about Bond movies as well, it got me thinking about Tenet. And I think that was another thing that was so good about it last year, that you couldn't go anywhere. But through that, you got to go to kind of Mumbai and Oslo and all these different places. So
London.
London's out of bounds for me.
We haven't been into the London town centre. We haven't been up west, have we?
I always prefer film holidays to actual holidays anyway, you know. Just easier, less faff, you know. You get the best views and everything. So,
You're not being bitten by mosquitoes. You've not lost your bag. Stuck somewhere. Not sunburnt. Yeah, you've not got people with selfie sticks spoiling every view. It's the perfect way to go on holiday. Maybe we'll just stay at home for the foreseeable.
Yeah.
Okay. So do join us next week. But for now, I think we'll say goodbye and go and retire to a film and enjoy a travel in our mind. Say goodbye, boys.
Bon voyage.
Bye. Au revoir.